talking with Dr. Robert Schock about pyramids. We were talking about the pyramids in Egypt, but as you mentioned, there are pyramids all around the world, and a number of them date older than the civilizations are supposed to be able to have constructed them. Give us an idea of some of the other areas as your research carried you in looking at pyramids in different places on different continents.
Yeah, well, pyramids are found basically on all continents except Antarctica and Australia. People tend to think of Egyptian pyramids. When they think of pyramids, I think that's just a function of our culture and society.
Yeah.
More pyramids are actually found in Mexico and Mesoamerica more generally than, as far as we know, any other part of the world. And in fact, many people are familiar with some of the Mesoamerican pyramids. And you have just as magnificent pyramids there. You get pyramids in South America, in the Peruvian Andes. You get pyramids, and it depends in part on how you define pyramid, but the way I define pyramid, you include things like parts of England and Ireland, Newgrange in Ireland, Silbury Hill in England, I think falls within the pyramid building tradition. In ancient times, many of them are gone now, but in ancient times you had pyramids throughout Mesopotamia and Sumeria. Very interestingly, you get them throughout India and Southeast Asia, and in particular in China. Many people are not aware of the pyramids in China because they're so poorly known, just because China has been such a closed and isolated society, both in the past, distant past and the very recent past. To this day, it's free travel in China is not always free and easy.
No,
and
you go where they want you to.
Exactly, and they do not, for whatever reason, they have not wanted to publicize their pyramids, but they in fact have incredible pyramids. I have in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders some photographs of some of the pyramids.
You have some amazing pictures in there. I mean, because there are examples of everything you're talking about. Now, another aspect of it are pyramids in North America.
Yes, North America, were sometimes known as the mounds or the mound builders. But in fact, they are pyramids. They are primarily earthwork pyramids, but they're right within the pyramid tradition that we find around the world.
Now, what's the age range of all of these? I mean, they don't all fall within the same group of centuries, do they?
No. In fact, pyramids around the world vary greatly in age, the pyramids that we know. And like we were talking about before, you have to remember that many pyramids that we see today are actually built on the sites of older pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
But they range from prior to 3000 B.C., for instance, in Peru and in China, what we know of some of the Chinese pyramids, all the way up to in Mesoamerica, they were still actively building pyramids in the 15th century A.D. when it was, quote, conquered by Europeans. So pyramid, and a lot of people don't realize this, pyramids and pyramid building traditions have spanned a continuous period. Period for 4,500 to 5,000 years or more around the world. For the vast majority of civilized time, or time since we've known of civilization, some culture somewhere has been building pyramids.
Is there either a mystical or a magical quality about that particular shape?
Well, this is something I discuss at length in the book. I would say, I don't know if I like the terms mystical and magical. I think it's rooted in real life. And I believe that pyramids have a lot of mythology surrounding them, a lot of common mythology and traditions around the world. They have to do with essentially the sky and what I refer to at one point in the book too, as sky religions, religions that reach up to the skies, that deal with the skies. Before the last break, you were starting to mention some of the little tunnels that we find, for instance, in Egyptian pyramids, and what's been found by the work of many different peoples. These have alignments with the sky. They're not just random little air shafts and tunnels, often referred to as air shafts, but they actually point to objects in the sky. You find solar and stellar alignments of pyramids all around the world. So this is one of the common themes, that they have something to do with the sky. And one thing that I talk about in both Voyages of the Pyramid Builders and actually my earlier book, Voices of the Rocks, is that I believe, and I'm not the only one with this belief, that there were things going on in the sky at certain periods in ancient times that we don't observe today. So there was a very, very real interest in what was happening in the sky. And in particular, I'm thinking in terms of cometary activity and activity in the sky that happens at certain periods in time that I believe had a real influence on pyramid building and other aspects of religion and society.
You know, I did mention the tunnels in the Egyptian pyramids. The thing that astounds me in terms of the construction is not only their ability to move and lift and place the huge stones that form the building, but that these little tiny passageways could be constructed within this mass. I mean,
exactly.
I'm not an engineer. I couldn't even begin to think,
right,
how the heck
right.
do you do that? You know?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I agree with you. I think some of the and not just the Egyptian pyramids, but pyramids around the world, some of the really amazing aspects are not so much just the pure massiveness and the huge size of the blocks in some cases, because, I mean, yeah, that's amazing that they could move the stuff. But I can personally visualize, well, you know, you have the time and energy and you move it a little bit by little bit. But the engineering feats of the alignments and getting those little passageways and little tunnels and shafts just oriented perfectly so they're pointing at what you want them to point to in the sky, I mean, it's amazing.
What was going on in the sky then that was different?
Well, what apparently, and this is based on both physical evidence, geological evidence, climatological evidence, mythological evidence, astrophysical evidence. Apparently what was happening is that at certain periods in time, the Earth's orbit intersects, and I'm oversimplifying to a certain extent, intersects the orbits of comets and cometary debris that orbits the sun. Mm-hmm. And we seem to go in and out of phases on approximately, in very crude terms, it's not exactly clockwork, but approximately 1,500 to 1,000 year cycle, we go in and out of cometary debris, the Earth's orbit. And this, in some cases, can have real effects on the surface of the Earth. Probably everything from seeing, you know, increased cometary activity in the sky, you know, in some cases, dazzling displays of comets. In the ancient literature, there are time periods when the ancients referred to two suns in the sky. One was probably a comet.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, cometary fragments, we referred to them usually as meteorites, actually hit the surface, may have caused destruction and damage. A modern example of that is known as Tunguska
in
1906
Russia.
In Russia, Siberia. Something came down and flattened just incredible expanse of forest. If it hit New York or Paris, everyone would know about it. Now, lots of people know about it, but lots of people don't know about it.
Yeah.
Given that hidden remote region of Siberia. But more than that, you don't need fragments of comets coming down and actually hitting to cause major social disruption, major changes. Because if you get a lot of debris in the upper atmosphere, that will cause climate changes. And we can pick those up, and we have picked those up in things like Greenland ice cores and tree rings, dendrochronology. You can get a very good feel for climate. You can get a feel for the amount of dust that was in the atmosphere. And there were times of major changes and turmoil. You have a couple of bad years weather-wise, and you can totally wipe out a crop, and this can cause mass famine and starvation. Be very unsettling. It could be very unsettling, will be very unsettling to a modern society, much less an ancient society.
Of course, there are those theories as to why these various civilizations disappeared. I mean, I'm thinking now, you know, the Aztecs and the Mayans and,
right,
and some of the Native American cultures and certainly around the world. Do you suspect that, in fact, it was something like this that, that then had the after effect of famine? So they had to move because they needed to find food?
When you say after effect, I think as a geologist, it was basically a simultaneous effect. You have one bad year of crops, mm-hmm, and things are happening very quickly. You know, even to this day, I don't know how many people realize that. To this day, on a global basis, we are very dependent every year on, you know, having a good crop coming in. I mean, you know, if all of a sudden the plants died off, the world would starve very quickly.
You mean I just can't run to my supermarket and buy some more bread?
I'm afraid not. No, this is something I'm interested in other contexts. Here we are, sophisticated people with our computers and everything. We're still dependent upon the elements. And so it was certainly the same back then. And I think, getting back to what we were talking about almost 2 hours ago, I mean, in some sense, I think, how do I want to say this? They had more of a concept of their place and their dependence on nature and the cosmos and things that they couldn't really control. But the pyramids, tying in with the pyramids, is, in my opinion, had a lot to do with it, this sort of reaching to the heavens, at least trying to understand what was going on in some cases. I mean, we don't want to oversimplify it, but trying to restore order to the heavens. Essentially a sky religion.
Yeah, well,
the root of virtually all religion that we have nowadays.
Yeah. I think we tend to think that we have developed our civilization and that we have technology and that we're in charge.
Exactly.
And the reality is we're not.
We're not.
I mean, ultimately, we're not. You have one good blizzard, you have one good hurricane, you have one massive earthquake or
exactly,
tidal wave or God knows, you know, you've got a whole variety of catastrophes. And we're wiped out because if you get rid of electricity, we don't have anything.
Exactly. All your food spoils.
That's right. You don't have any water. You don't have any food. Your house burns down.
Yeah. No. We are so dependent, and yet I think the average person in the streets does not really realize that.
No. In terms of where these things came from, I'm still intrigued by the fact that the Sphinx is so much older and that this pyramid building, you know, has such a range of years. Who did it? Who were these people? And is it another case of what happened to them? I mean, is that a legitimate question to ask?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely a legitimate question to ask. And it really depends on where you're looking. I mean, we're talking a global, if you would, in the broad sense, a global culture of pyramid building. Not simultaneously around the world. And I think, and this is something I trace in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, I think you can trace all this pyramid building back to a central origin that essentially spread throughout the world. And so, you know, it was earlier in some portions of the world, later in other portions of the world. The beginning, in my assessment, is not Egypt. That's one of the early side branches. The beginning is not Japan or Peru. That's one of the early side branches. And later side branches, if you would, go into Mesoamerica, Mexico in particular, into parts of India. So, you know, there's a diffusion. In fact, one thing I talk about to a great extent in the book is the concept of diffusion of culture and thoughts and ideas, society, pyramids being just one aspect of diffusion of culture around the world.
Yeah, but and where did it start?
Where it started, the conclusion I come to is that it started in a place known as Sundaland.
And when Sundaland?
Sundaland.
Where's that?
And Sundaland is basically underwater now. It's between, essentially, between the Indonesian region, Borneo, Southeast Asia, Malaysia. If people know that region, it's now covered by the southern portion of the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a region, it's known as Sunda or Sunda Land by geologists, very well known among geologists. It was a region essentially the size of a small continent that was buried with water at the end of the last ice age. And when I say the end of the last ice age, thinking as a geologist, relatively recently in the 6,000 to 4,000 BC period. Most people are familiar with the ice ages. A lot of water was locked up in glaciers as they melted. To make a long story shorter and simpler, sea levels rose.
Yes.
This was one region that apparently was a very lush area. It was above sea level then. It was covered with water. It was drowned. It's now covered with fairly shallow water. When I say shallow, a couple hundred feet. But that's deeper than you can live in.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of evidence points back to this region as being, I believe, the origin of pyramid building culture and civilization that then spread out as it was covered with water. I mean, they had to go somewhere.
So their land started to be covered.
Exactly.
And they left. But are there remnants of their civilization there? I mean, if Robert Ballard sent Alvin down there, could he take pictures of what's left?
Well, this has not been done yet. This has not been done yet. And even though it's relatively recent geologically, well, let me answer your question. My answer to your question is I believe, yes,
mm-hmm.
that you would find something down there. But you have to understand that even though we know the general area, to find specifics, you know, it's still finding the needle in the haystack, as they say. Even though a typical pyramid, if they were building, which I suspect they were, pyramids like the size of Egyptian pyramids or Mexican pyramids, I mean, good sized structures.
Mm-hmm.
Still, to find that under a couple hundred feet of water, 6,000 to 8,000 years later, with silt and sedimentation, etc., it's not going to be a simple task.
Well, but that's where that the military satellite imaging would be golden.
Exactly. This is where classified imaging would probably do the best.
Oh, my. I mean, let's see that.
You think about finding, now it was under much deeper water, the Titanic. But on the other hand, the Titanic, you know, went down only a century ago.
That's
and
true.
And you know very specifically what you're looking for, you know, I don't want to say exactly where, but pretty much where to look for it, et cetera. And that was a major task to find. So, I mean, these are not easy tasks. And doing any kind of underwater archaeology is incredibly difficult.
These people, then, I want to pursue this with you when we come back, is who were they and where did they go? How did they get there? And then, of course, ultimately, I guess the question would be is, you know, where did they wind up and did they just disappear or do we have remnants of them or part of us today somewhere, which I guess is possible, but we'll find out more. My guest, Dr. Robert M. Schock, S-C-H-O-C-H, and the website would be www.robertschock.homestead.com. And again, the last name is S-C-H-O-C-K. The book, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. I'm Barbara Simpson.